Welcome to the President's Inbox, a CFR podcast about the foreign policy challenges facing the United States. I'm Jim Lindsay, Director of Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. This week's topic is China's threat to Taiwan. With me to discuss whether China might use force to compel Taiwan's reunification with the mainland is Oriana Skylar-Mastro. Oriana is a center fellow at Stanford University's Freeman Spohley Institute for International Studies and a non-resident senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. She is also an inaugural Wilson Center China Fellow and serves in the United States Air Force Reserve as a strategic planner at U.S. Indo-Pacific Command. From 2016 to 2017, Oriana was a Stanton Nuclear Security Fellow at the Council. She is the author of The Taiwan Temptation, Why Beijing Might Resort to Force, which appeared in the July-August 2021 issue of Foreign Affairs. Oriana, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
I'd like to begin, if we may, Oriana, with something you wrote in your recent foreign affairs piece. You wrote, quote, "Although a Chinese invasion of Taiwan may not be imminent, it is time to take seriously the possibility that China could soon use force to end its almost century-long civil war." Why are you concerned that China might resort to force, something it has avoided for the past 70 years?
Well, I don't know if I would even use the word avoided. I mean, I think China has been waiting and preparing. Reunification is the word that they use with Taiwan, has been the number one priority of the Communist Party since 1949. They would have liked to do it much, much sooner. There were a number of Taiwan Straits crises in which China was using force, and we all thought that the Civil War would probably restart the 1950s. It just never did. And since then, China has not had the military capabilities to take Taiwan by force. You know, to me, it's not surprising, for example, that we saw more assertive Chinese behavior in the South China Sea once they had ships that could reach the South China Sea. Or in the case of Taiwan, they couldn't even fly in the airspace close to Taiwan until the mid-1990s, and they had no capability to take Taiwan by force. And we're talking the full-scale amphibious landing until today. As I argue in my article, this capability is something that has just come online recently, and many China military specialists debate whether or not they can even do this now. So I think it's mainly driven by a capabilities issue. And now that they can do this, and they're also very strong in terms of international influence, so it's possible, they won't pay huge costs for trying. I think this is very tempting, hence the title of the article.
If I understand you correctly, Oriana, you think that growing Chinese capabilities have changed Chinese intentions. That is, Chinese military planners, potentially Chinese leaders, are thinking more seriously about possibly using force because they think it's more doable today than it ever has been in the past.
I wouldn't say it changed Chinese intentions because China's intentions were always to reunify with Taiwan. So the whole military modernization program that Xi Jinping in particular has undergone with a great sense of urgency since 2013 has been designed to conduct the exact type of joint operations that are necessary to take Taiwan. Now, of course, the military capability is only part of it. The other side of this is that China has had a policy to, you know, reunify with Taiwan, in their words, called peaceful reunification. And this policy is designed to enhance the ties between mainland and Taiwan, especially economic ties, with the design to convince the people of Taiwan to want to be a part of mainland China. So another part of this is that I would argue that this policy has not worked. I don't think the people of Taiwan are particularly enthusiastic about joining the China dream. I think latest polling shows only 5-6% say that this is something that they would want. And I'm not the only one who notices this. You know, in Beijing, they also notice that peaceful reunification doesn't seem to be working. They don't only look at public opinion polling, but they also look at Taiwan domestic politics. The current president of Taiwan, Tsai Ing-wen, won a re-election. She's not particularly friendly to Beijing. So it's also the failure of that policy. And I look at the Chinese writings, and to me, it's very interesting. You know, you can't really criticize openly the Communist Party, but you can openly write that this policy is not working. And so in general, when there's that kind of open of a debate about something, that means that they're considering other options.
Do you think the issue of reunification, Oriana, is more important to President Xi than to his predecessors?
That's hard to say. I don't think it's more important, but I think it is higher on his agenda, if that makes sense. It's higher on his agenda, I think, because of the doability of it. His predecessors probably would have listed Taiwan as, you know, the number one issue, but that was much more of a rhetorical thing because it was, you know, nothing that could be done. Of course, if Taiwan had declared independence previously, you know, China would have had to fight, would have done everything, you know, humanly possible to prevent that. And that used to be the only real scenario that we considered to spark a war. So what I was trying to do with that article is to say, you know, Taiwan declaring independence is not the most likely pathway to war anymore. Instead, it's, you know, Beijing seizing this opportunity.
Your article has triggered a fair amount of response. Foreign Affairs, in its current issue, September, October, has a part set aside where critics respond to your argument. And sort of a common theme through the criticisms is that you are overstating the threat of a Chinese invasion. So maybe you can sort of walk us through your response to those criticisms that the threat is far less than what you are painting.
Sure. I mean, first I'll say, Jim, I was so surprised with the response. I mean, it's probably because I live in this like little bubble, right? In which all I do is study the Chinese military, right? And so I read the Chinese writings. I was at a track, you know, 1.5 in China on Taiwan, talking to the Chinese government about it. And so to me, this shift was very apparent in Chinese thinking. I mean, if you had asked me, you know, 2 years ago, even if I would have written this article, I would have said no, right? There's no way China would use force against Taiwan. But China is so dynamic that you have to change your opinions when the data changes. And so a lot of my critics, they sort of highlight the 3 points that I was trying to make that have changed. The first is they say, you know, China doesn't have the capability to do this. The second point is that the economic costs would be too high. And the third point is that they say that China can wait forever to do this. And so to go through these points very briefly, I mean, the first thing is that whether they can take the island, I would argue a lot of it depends on, you know, what they think themselves. And we've also done numerous analyses of this. It's not the case that China wins every time, right? I'm not arguing that the Chinese military is stronger than the U.S. military. I'm not even arguing that the PLA thinks this is easy. Any PLA analyst that I've read says this would be very, very difficult joint operation, very complex to do an amphibious assault of this sort. But on the U.S. defense side, there are situations in which, you know, the U.S. Department of Defense has assessed that China could win. And I don't think it's crazy to think that if that assessment has been made in the United States, the Chinese planners have made the same assessment. For example, if, you know, the United States doesn't get enough early warning, if China is able to move quickly. A lot of my critics use what I would say are irrelevant comparisons to say, you know, China can't do this. For example, you know, what did it take for the United States to take Okinawa in World War II? You know, and I would say, well, you know, the Japanese had a military of 6 million. They had been fighting for decades. Do you think it takes the same amount to dislodge them as it takes to dislodge, you know, 180,000 Taiwan army members who have never fought a day in their life? Or even thinking about tonnage of fleets, you know, the nature of warfare has changed such that now we're going to, you know, lighter, sleeker fleets. Or some talk about the Falcons and, you know, well, Great Britain tried to use civilian ships and that didn't work. Well, Great Britain tried to use 62 civilian ships and China has thousands and thousands. And so, again, I don't mean to suggest that it's easy, but a lot of times we go to these comparisons that I just don't think are relevant. They have the largest Coast Guard in the world, you know, by some respects, they have the largest navy in the world, definitely the largest, you know, in the region. And they've organized and practicing this for a very long time. So I don't think we should dismiss it. And the economic costs, that's a different type of thing of like, how do you think the world's going to respond? And we can have difference of opinions. I don't know how you feel about this, Jim, but it looks to me like the idea that the whole world's going to cut off diplomatic and economic ties with China indefinitely if they use force against Taiwan. I mean, I wish that were the case, but how countries have been reacting so far to China's rise and China's international behavior suggests to me that that's unlikely. And I think the party also thinks it's unlikely.
So Oriana, before we talk about how the world might respond to a Chinese invasion of Taiwan, could you walk us through how you see this situation unfolding? Are we talking a bolt out of the blue? Is it a sort of gradual strangulation of Taiwan? Something in between?
There are downsides to the gradual strangulation of Taiwan. And this goes back to some of the assumptions, my differing assumptions with some critics. I do not think the people of Taiwan are going to agree to be a part of mainland China without Chinese boots on the ground, on the island. You know, all the psychological warfare, you know, legal warfare, diplomatic strangulation. I think China absolutely isn't going to engage in all of those types of kind of, you know, gray zone or low intensity strangulation. deregulation types of activities. The question is that enough to get Taiwan? I don't think so. And that's why I still think there's this threat of an actual kinetic invasion. Some of my critics sort of say, well, you know, China doesn't need to attack Taiwan because they have these lower level tools. And so I don't know, you know, we just have to kind of agree to disagree on that, or maybe ask the people of Taiwan on that issue. But I think the gradual strangulation, of course, it can get them closer and closer, but it can't get them all the way. So in the end, they're going to have to decide, are we going to do this or not? So maybe they do some of that to better prepare the battlefield, right? To weaken Taiwan resolve, absolutely. But when they do decide to move, moving quickly and decisively is what they're going to want to do. Because if the United States has the time to amass forces and respond, then their likelihood of victory plummets. And also the likelihood of a protracted war, which is a whole separate Chinese debate about whether or not they have an advantage in a protracted war. But for the most part, they think they're at a disadvantage there. So they're going to want to move quickly. And of course, you know, if they move quickly and it looks like it doesn't go their way, I think they have options. I think they can pull back to an offshore island, or they can say, you know, they were just doing an exercise or trying to teach Taiwan a lesson. You know, I think, you know, the costs of the attempt are actually also low. So, you know, U.S. deterrence has succeeded to date because we've convinced China, one, that they will not succeed, but two, that the costs of trying will be high. And right now, I just see the costs of trying to Xi Jinping to not be particularly high.
So in essence, the scenario you imagine is something along the lines of D-Day or the landing at Incheon?
Right. So it's going to be trying to get a lot of people across the strait. And, you know, Lyle Goldstein at the Naval War College talks about how it will be different than D-Day because they'll use thousands of thousands of these maritime militia ships that they have in addition to the traditional Navy ships. So I think it'll probably be a combination of, you know, landing dock platforms, of traditional Navy platforms to take people across the strait, and these sort of civilian commercial type of vessels that can also take people across, and also airdropping. So the PLA has also talked about sort of dropping people in from the air. So it'll be a bit of both.
So wouldn't that give the United States a fair amount of advance notice? I wouldn't imagine you could carry off an amphibious attack of that size without having to mass forces, which in this day and age can easily be observed by satellites, thereby making it even harder for the Chinese to achieve their objectives?
So there's two things that are happening. The first is you probably see a lot in the news, a lot of Chinese military activity across the strait, right? So they are normalizing like mobilizations. So when we look at, you know, are there people being called onto duty? You know, are aircraft preparing to take off? A couple of weeks ago, they had, you know, 25 aircraft, a whole fleet head towards Taiwan, right? So they're normalizing this type of large scale activity. So it's possible, and they often say they're just doing large scale exercises, that they do a lot of this preparation under the guise of that. And we sort of become inured, you know, to this type of activity because we see it now every single day, right? China flew, but within I think it's the AIDIS of Taiwan 320 times last year.
This is the air defense identification zone.
Right. So that's part of it. Another part of it is satellites. You have to have your satellites in the right place to see everything. We can talk about, you know, whether the rebalancing to the Pacific has actually happened. You know, when there is a debate or discussion between CENTCOM and INDOPACOM for national assets, which satellites are national assets, who gets them? There's also the issue of the fact that the United States does not have the bandwidth to process most of the raw data it gets from intelligence. So recently, General Van Herk, who's the commander of NORTHCOM, wrote a piece in War on the Rocks in which they're working on an initiative to try to bring in machine learning to help process all this information. So it's possible that we don't get warning. And then, you know, unfortunately, there's not great estimates in the unclassified realm of how much warning the United States needs. So I can't talk specifically about that, but I'll just say that it does take us a very long time to get our act together. So we're not talking about, you know, will we know a few days ahead of time? Sure. But the United States needs more time than that. So on the other side of it, besides being able to process this information, you know, the United States is trying to learn how to better mobilize its assets more quickly from around the world.
Is it fair to say that if the Chinese were to go down the road that you have sketched out, that it would be a high-risk maneuver?
Yes, it's a high-risk, high-reward maneuver. But like I said, I think if it doesn't go their way, they have other options. So it's not the case that, you know, once they start moving on Taiwan, let's just say, you know, the United States gets tipped off, or we respond more strongly than they thought, or, you know, even allies. For example, if Japan is willing to support the United States in a fight over Taiwan, China loses. China has a lot of advantages because of geography, right? The United States has one airbase within 800 800 kilometers of this area where we would be fighting. China has 39. And so a lot of it is geography. So if, you know, Japan was fully in it, that would really help also the use of the Japanese Navy. So if something happened that was unexpected, you know, like I said, I think they just say, you know, we were just firing a warning shot, now we're going home. So it is high risk. If they get boots on the ground in Taiwan, you know, then there's nothing that we can do to get them off. I think that's sort of a game over. You can't compel them to leave at that point. So you really have this window of opportunity as they're trying to cross to stop them.
But if this is a high risk operation, even taking into account your point that they could stop if they're getting more resistance than they anticipate, why would they go down that road? I mean, I take it there are plenty of examples in history of countries pursuing high risk operations, the Japanese attacks on Pearl Harbor being perhaps at the top of the list. Probably also can add China's entry into the Korean War. But if capabilities are tilting so decisively in Beijing's favor, why wouldn't Beijing just sort of wait for the apple to drop from the tree?
Well, because I don't know what that looks like. I mean, the apple's never going to drop. Again, like, even if they have all the capabilities in the world, Taiwan's never going to agree to this unless China takes it by force. And there's this idea of like, okay, why can't they just wait forever? And this is maybe the least, you know, scientific part of the argument, but it just seems to me very strange, you know, against human nature that your number one goal and motivation, like in the world, if it's within your grasp, you just say, oh, I'm just going to, you know, why don't I wait a couple of decades? I mean, I just don't think that's how we work. You know, I sort of half joke, I just started my job at Stanford a year ago and I was poached from Georgetown. And because, you know, I just started, they gave me extra time to try to get tenure, but I'm not going to wait 5 years before I go up to tenure. The second that I've, you know, met those standards, I'm going to go up. So, you know, Xi Jinping has said China cannot complete its rejuvenation until it has Taiwan. And they have a sense of urgency about regaining their standing in the international system. And so I just think it goes against, you know, the logic of Xi Jinping, the feeling of the sense of motivation and drive within China to continue rising, to sort of say, you know, why can't you just be happy without, you know, fulfilling your potential, in their words. I just don't see that as the feeling and sentiment within Beijing.
In my understanding of the scenario is that the Chinese would wait till such point as it's clear that the United States could not deter or defend Taiwan. At that point, the United States would signal, whether intentionally or otherwise, that it's not going to risk a great power war with China over Taiwan, and then it would be game over.
So I think China thinks that's never going to happen. So one of my critics did sort of argue that there is this view of the U.S. being on decline in a lot of Chinese writing. So, you know, why can't they just wait until the United States is weak in that sort of scenario? But China has a different view of what decline means, one that is actually more accurate in the historical record, which is declining powers very rarely just sort of gracefully exit the stage. You know, and I don't mean to suggest that the United States is in decline. I'm just taking sort of the Chinese position as a given. They think that the more the United States is in decline, the more likely that the United States is going to be aggressive to try to hold on to its position in Asia. So actually, by that logic, as time passes, if the United States gets weaker and weaker, the more and more likely the United States, one, is willing to intervene in Taiwan, and two, willing to pay huge costs, right, to maintain its position in Asia. It's no longer about Taiwan. It's about its position in Asia. And we already see this in the U.S. debate about Taiwan, that, you know, a lot of times the rationale that's being brought up is about these broader great power competition dynamics, not about Taiwan itself. So I think from the Chinese perspective, either the United States is, you know, going to be doubling down on military capabilities, which some people have argued because we've sort of realized our conventional deterrent has been weakened. We are making significant changes that won't come online for another 5 to 10 years. You know, so now there's a window of opportunity. Or they think the United States is going to get weaker, in which case the United States gets more aggressive and is willing to pay higher costs to fight. In either case, it seems like the United States of the future is worse to deal with than the United States of today.
Oriana, let's talk a little bit about the U.S. national interest in preserving the status quo. Throughout this conversation, you have been talking about what the United States should do and what it is that Beijing thinks the United States would do. But I imagine a lot of people listening to our conversation would ask, why is it in America's national interest to risk a great power war over Taiwan? After all, we do not have a mutual defense treaty with Taiwan. We haven't had one since Jimmy Carter terminated it back in 1979. So what is the national interest that you see in the United States defending Taiwan and risking a potentially catastrophic war with China?
So this is the tough question. And I think it is very dependent person to person on what you value, and what type of country you think the United States is or that you want the United States to be. It is very easy to avoid war, not only in the case of Taiwan, but across the board. You just completely accommodate what the other side wants, and then you don't have to fight them. The problem is that China has presented itself as an actor in the region, as one that wants complete control and dominance over Asia, and Asia is the most economically and politically dynamic region of the world. If the United States does not have a say in the dynamics of Asia, it will hurt the U.S. domestically, economically, and politically.
How so? I mean, what would be your argument to that person who's neutral on this issue and looks out and says, why should the United States be guaranteeing the current status quo with Taiwan?
Right. So, I mean, I don't have the stats right in front of me, but economically, you know, how much, you know, trillions and trillions of dollars the United States would lose by not being able to trade, you know, freely with countries, or not being able to have the power to negotiate the type of trade deals that are favorable, you know, to the United States. There's also the sort of security issue, and people can have differing views on this, but the United States has had a view since World War II that it is cheaper for us to be present militarily to deter, right? And sometimes deterrence means you have to fight, than be absent and allow for large-scale wars to be happening all the time, right? We haven't had a large-scale war since World War II. We haven't had one in Asia because the U.S. military is there. I mean, this is something that is, in my mind, undebatable. You look at Chinese PLA writings, that's all they talk about. They would love to do all sorts of things that would cause these major wars, disruptions around the world that would probably bring in the United States in the end anyway, because it would reach our shores. So it's cheaper and easier, actually, for us to deter them and even have to fight them over Taiwan than it would be to allow them to dominate the region, cause a lot of wars that we would have to be involved in later at greater disadvantages. So for me, it's a very sort of pragmatic argument. I think a lot of people have a more values-oriented argument, which they say, you know, the role of the United States is to protect other countries worthy of our protection, and we can't allow democracies to be overrun by autocracies like this. You know, that would just sort of encourage it. There's also a strategic argument that once China has Taiwan, this whole military modernization that they've focused on that has made them arguably the second most powerful military in the world, you know, what are they going to focus on next? They will also control all the most advanced semiconductors. That whole industry is in Taiwan.
Well, that's if it survives the war.
Right. Well, I've actually talked to some industry experts that say it can be rebuilt. You know, you have the people there, the engineers and stuff. So even if it were bombed, it could be rebuilt within a year. I mean, if you look at how we're trying to in the United States now build up that industry, I think in Texas in particular, it takes about a year. So they still would have the know-how and the technology. And anyone who has tried to rent a car recently sees that prices are like four times what they used to be. And that's because of the difficulty during COVID of producing cars, because even cars need those semiconductors. Everything we use needs those. And so it would have a huge daily effect. But of course, then the question is that worth what would probably be tens of thousands of Americans? That is a very, very difficult question to answer.
So let's talk about what the U.S. policy response should be. I take it your argument is not going to be that the United States should write off Taiwan and spend its billions or trillions of dollars building up a semiconductor industry here in the United States so we don't rely on Taiwan, but rather you want the United States to make changes. Is it in defense posture or in foreign policy or both?
The changes that I advocate for are mainly in posture, not policy. And so I think that arguments for more strategic clarity in the U.S. willingness to defend Taiwan do nothing to enhance deterrence, and if anything, make war more likely.
I should note, Ariana, that that argument is associated with my boss, Richard Haass, the president
Yes.
of the Council on Foreign Relations. Maybe you could sketch briefly what is meant by it.
Right. So a lot of people, I think, have what I would call an outdated view of the deterrence situation across the Strait. They think that the main thing that deters China is the threat that the United States would intervene, right? Because in the 1990s, the last time we had a big cross-strait issue, you know, the presence of an aircraft carrier was enough to tell the Chinese to calm down. But a lot has changed in 25 years. I mean, even that one instance, the Chinese learned, okay, you know, not to not mess with the United States. What they learned was to build a missile that could hit an aircraft carrier, which they have since done. And so the people who argue for strategic clarity, like your boss, they think that if the United States were just more clear that we would come to Taiwan's defense, that would be sufficient to deter Beijing. But in my discussions with Chinese military officials, officials, in my readings, you know, they assume U.S. intervention. They assume it in their plans. And then their question is, can we still win? So to me, the uncertainty is not about U.S. resolve. Of course, if the United States tomorrow says we won't defend Taiwan, you know, that has a huge impact. But the ambiguity of the U.S. commitment is not what is the main mechanism here. It's uncertainty about U.S. capability.
Okay, so that's what you mean when you say you don't need to have changes in policy. So what are the changes in posture that you think are necessary for the United States to pursue?
The first thing is, I would say, putting land-based missiles in the second island chain in Asia. So this seems like a very detailed response. And so maybe for some of our listeners, I'll just sort of go through why.
What is the second island chain would probably help.
Yeah. So we sort of separate out, you know, based on, you know, how far from Chinese mainland. The first island chain is basically the waters that are between China and Japan and Taiwan, you know, down to the Philippines. It's what you might heard of as like the East China Sea and South China Sea, right? The second island chain is the waters basically beyond Taiwan that move into the Pacific. So those waters, like where there's a lot of small island nations, for example, that is where I'm arguing that you would want to put these land-based systems. So under the Trump administration, the United States pulled out of the INF.
This is the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty.
Right. So the United States doesn't have any of these intermediate range missiles. China, I think their force is about 70% of those types of missiles. So right now we don't have these missiles. And also it's difficult to convince countries to host them for you, right? Because the United States is not a resident power in Asia. So we'd have to convince countries, you know, like the Philippines, it's mainly within that second island chain, you know, to host them for us and some smaller island nations. But basically, if we could saturate the strait with firepower, then the Chinese, you know, couldn't physically make it across. That's the type of mentality that I have when I'm thinking of deterring China.
This is deterrence by denial.
Exactly. Deterrence by denial, which is different than deterrence by punishment, which I also think in some cases, our military overly relies on deterrence by punishment. They think if I can impose a high cost on China, then China won't move. But I believe that if you told Xi Jinping, you'll lose your navy, but you can get Taiwan, he would do it. The price of Taiwan is so high, it's hard to impose a high enough cost on China that is also credible, right? Like, because the United States, of course, could threaten, I don't know, you know, to nuke China or something, but that's not credible.
Well, but the Chinese could also threaten back again.
Exactly. That's also why it's not credible, is that the United States, if you're concerned about U.S. resolve, we definitely do not have the resolve to fight a nuclear war over this. And so you basically have to think of military maneuvers to be able to physically stop them. And so, you know, getting the Japanese on board would be great. Having these, you know, land-based missiles would be great. There was a report that I was actually a part of at CFR that also talked about Taiwan. And one of their recommendations was to get, you know, the international community to cut off economic ties with China. This would work. I think this would threaten China's rejuvenation enough that the Taiwan prize would not be worth it if they thought that then they would have no connectivity with U.S. allies and partners in perpetuity. But again, I just think that's a lot more difficult to get, right? Right now, you might look at a few statements that Japan makes or Australia makes, but we are far from a commitment of, you know, completely economically isolating China, which, you know, would be detrimental to these economies, in which most part our allies in Asia rely more on China for trade than they do on us. But I just point that out, that if we were able, you know, to get that kind of commitment and China found it credible, that they would be diplomatically and economically isolated indefinitely, that would also be sufficient.
Oriana, we spent a lot of time talking about how this issue looks from Beijing, how it looks from Washington. We haven't talked a lot about Taiwan itself. Maybe if we can, like, to close there, particularly with the question of whether or not, in your judgment, Taiwan is doing what it needs to do to deter a Chinese attack and, if necessary, to defend themselves. I mean, you're well aware there are plenty of writers out there. Tanner Greer comes to mind, who argue that the Taiwanese aren't doing what they need to do. And so why should the United States do it for them? How do you answer that line of inquiry?
They're absolutely right. That's one of the main difficulties with getting, you know, the resolve of the United States to defend Taiwan, is that domestically in Taiwan, they are not, first of all, they're not putting the money that they need to towards defense, right? So again, why should the United States pay for it if they're not willing to? But more importantly, you know, they've tried to switch to an all-volunteer force, and they can't get people to sign up to fight, you know, to their military. So, you know, they don't have the kind of, people often compare Taiwan to Israel, which is under the same sort of constant threat. You know, they don't have the type of conscription, the type of, you know, level of service across the board of getting people to be involved in the military, which, you know, every person between 18 and 60 can kind of pick up a gun. And so those changes definitely have to happen. And those are deep societal changes, there's some lag time. You know, they've been living under this threat of Beijing for a while, but the threat was never really real. You know, if you buy my argument, it wasn't really real until a couple months ago, really. So, you know, can they play catch up? No one expects Taiwan to be able to defend itself. No one. I mean, if there's scenarios in which the United States loses against China, you know, basically Taiwan does not stand a chance on its own. The question is, can they hold off long enough to allow the United States to amass the force that the United States needs to prevail against China, right? That's all we need, right? So whether it is, you know, mining or hardening or, you know, a lot of these more defensive orientated postures, which Taiwan has in some cases been much more interested in buying prestige weapons, you know, fighters and things, and they have been in building their defenses. That's the type of thing that we need more of. And also that the people of Taiwan can demonstrate, you know, their willingness to, you know, chi ku in the Chinese of, you know, eating bitterness, which the Chinese say that they're willing to do to take Taiwan. The people of Taiwan willing to do the same to stop a Chinese invasion? That's a big open question.
And with that big open question, we're going to close up the President's Inbox for this week. My guest has been Oriana Skylar-Mastro, a Center Fellow at Stanford University's Freeman Spoley Institute for International Studies and a non-resident Senior Fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Her article, "The Taiwan Temptation, Why Beijing Might Resort to Force," appeared in the July-August 2021 issue of Foreign Affairs, and a response article appears in the September-October issue of Foreign Affairs. Oriana, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Please subscribe to the President's Inbox on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen, and leave us a review. They help us get noticed and improve the show. As always, opinions expressed on the President's Inbox are solely those of the host or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's episode was produced by Zoe Collis with senior producer Jeremy Sherlock. Zoe also did double duty as our recording engineer. Thank you, Zoe. Special thanks go out to Margaret Gatch for her assistance. This is Jim Lindsay. Thanks for listening.